Well, yeah. If I haven't met you, I'm glad you're here with us today. This weekend, Easter, it's quite a weekend that we celebrate in Australia, at least, every year. We have a good public holiday and it's a good time off. But I don't know if you have come along because you heard the title of the talk. It's called Easter, It's a Matter of Life and Death. Now, I'm not sure if you guys have experienced any life and death situations yourself. I have. I think I've experienced a few. I'm just going to tell you of one. I'll tell you one. So, a few years ago, it was my wife, then girlfriend. It was her 21st birthday. And at the time, I was like, I'm going to try and do something nice. You know how it is. Treat her. So, what I thought, I went and brought all her nice food that she likes, made a picnic, organised to go down to Catherine Hill Bay. Do you guys know where Catherine Hill Bay is? Yep. Organised to go for a picnic down there. We hadn't been there together. Go for a bushwalk, look out over the ocean. And kind of the main reason why I wanted to go there was there's this jump rock, which is kind of like a cliff into the ocean there. So if you kind of go south of where the wharf is, you walk around. Actually, I probably shouldn't tell you, but anyway, it's somewhere around there. And I've never done that jump rock before, but I was like, this would be fun. We'll get to do this on my 21st birthday. Now, I was told about this by a friend at work. He said, you know, it's a good rock. It's pretty safe. There's just one kind of rock that looks like you won't make it, but you will. So, you just got to make sure you jump out. Don't pin drop. You know how you see people jump rocks and they're like, and you're like, what are you doing? Jump out, get out. Anyway, so he said, just make sure you run and jump, clear it. So when I saw it, I was like, my goodness, okay. You really do have to run and jump. It's underwater, but it's just shallow. Like it'd only be like a meter underwater, depending on the tide. So I didn't really want to send my girlfriend off first. Although I would have liked that, but yeah, I was a bit nervous. And I trusted my workmate, which now that I think about it, it's a bit crazy. Anyway, so I just ran and jumped off. I remember hitting the water. I remember looking at the rock, and I remember I cleared it. But then from that point that I hit the water, I actually don't remember what happened. The first thing I remember was kind of going, oh, that's a bit weird. What just happened? And as I was floating to the surface, I was like, oh, that's weird. Never experienced that before. And as I reached the surface, I realised I couldn't feel my arms or my legs. So I kind of got to the surface and I was like, oh, wow, that's okay. And then I looked at my arm and I remember trying to control the movement of my arm and it was uncontrollable. And I'm just looking at it going, what is going on? Like, am I paralysed? Like, am I not going to be able to control any movement from now on? So I kind of filled up my lungs and floated there with my arms uncontrollable and my legs. I couldn't feel anything. And I said, Miri, my wife, Miri, I can't feel, I yell out, I can't feel my arms and my legs. And I'm looking up and she's like, what? I said, I can't feel them. And so she's trying to get there. She had to run around down to the water. Several minutes later, movement started coming back. I was starting to be able to control it. And so I kind of swam over to where the water's edge and got down the rocks. And I remember just there's this tingling. I don't know if anyone's had kind of that, but it's tingling all up and down my arms. Miriam's dad is a doctor, so we called him and said, this just happened, what should we do? And he said, go straight to John Hunter Hospital. We jumped in the car and she drove me straight to John Hunter Hospital. As soon as I got there, I told them the story. And they said, they put me in a neck brace, lied me flat on the bed, and for about the next 4 hours, with a few scans and stuff, I was just lying there wondering, I can still feel stuff, but am I not going to be able, what's going on here? Like, what's the big worry? Then 4 hours later, the neurologist, I think that's what he's called, Yeah. The guy that knows what he's talking about. I had heaps of doctors that didn't know, and they couldn't make any kind of, you're right. He came. And he kind of said, sit up, and I was like, phew, I can sit up, that's good. And just tested me and told me that I have a narrow spinal canal. So, my spinal cord went through it like that, and so on impact, the soft tissue hit my spinal cord and temporarily kind of paralysed my body. Anyway, that was, I didn't know it at the time, but looking back, that was a real life or death situation for me. I didn't know when I was jumping off that that was going to be the case. And I'm sure you can probably think of your own personal life or death situations or near misses. You know, I've got a few, like my sister was driving us in the car and I thought we were going to die. We were side swiping between trees. There was a time in the surf where I thought I was going to die. But Easter, right? A matter of life and death? Really? Like, for most of us, Easter's just a sweet long weekend. It's a chance to go on a holiday, to go on a surf trip. It's a chance to perhaps, if you're a med student, pretend that you're going to do assignment to catch up on work. And for most of us in Australia, you know, life or death is not on the agenda at all when we're thinking about Easter. But today, I want to put to you that Easter is, in fact, a matter of life and death. And what we do with the events that happened 2,000 years ago, that very first Easter, is in fact a matter of life and death for us. So to do that, we're going to have a look at this text that we have here that we got read out. You have an outline so that you've got handed in. If that's helpful, we're going to work through that. If that's helpful, you can work through that. But the first thing I really want to do is just point out that this document that we have is it's a historical account of what happened. That's my first point. So to do that, I'm going to kind of quickly work through 5 points. So on the outline, you'll see first point one, there's slight inconsistencies in the gospel account. So read with me in verse one. On the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early, while it was still dark. She saw that the stone had been removed from the tomb. See here, John tells us that it was Mary Magdalene that came and saw that the stone had been removed. Now we do, in the Bible, we have kind of three other biographical accounts of this event. And in the other accounts, interestingly enough, there's slight differences in who exactly it was that came to the tomb. So for example, in Luke 24, we read that it was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the other women who went to the tomb. Now, I have an engineering background, and so when it comes to these differences, straight away I'm kind of like, hang on a sec, was it just Mary, or was it Mary and others that went to the tomb? You know, who was it that actually saw it? And at first, when you read this, there's kind of these differences seem to stand out as you read these accounts. Now, why am I pointing all this out? Well, it's actually the opposite to what you'd expect with these differences. See, as a historian, they kind of look for kind of the sameness or continuity, whatever, and difference in their accounts. So it's actually in the differences that they can kind of testify to the historical nature and the reliability of what they have. So it's not simply that they've just copied each other's story or, you know, using the same words, got together and tried to make some myth up, but they're actually recording events, recording history as they saw it happened. So that's my first point. The differences actually add to us and they help us to understand that this is history, intended to be history. So second point, when you read the account, there's lots of details in here, and so there's plenty of details that John has recorded for us. So I'm only going to pick up a few of the kind of interesting ones. So first one I want to pick up is this running race. It's this description of a running race between Peter and John. I mean, read verse 3. So Mary had just told them that the tomb's empty. Then in verse 3 we read this. At that, Peter and the other disciples went out, heading for the tomb. The two were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and got to the tomb first. See, it's such an odd detail, isn't it? Like, why did John, the other disciple, include this? I mean, surely it's not really needed at all. The only thing it really points out is that John, you know, he's a bit quicker and faster than Peter, and Peter's a bit of a slow coach. And really, I reckon John's a bit proud of that, kind of, you know. Yeah, I outran you, Peter. And John knows that, and Peter knows that, and so he's etched it into history. And poor Peter, like, he's always going to be known as the slow coach that couldn't get to the tomb fast enough. But there's this detail here. The second detail in verse 7, you know, the detail about the linen cloth and the head wrapping. So read verse 7 with me. The wrapping that had been on his head was not lying with the linen cloth, but was folded up in a separate place by itself. I mean, why would you emphasize this? Like, seriously. See, at the time, there was speculation, and Mary actually thought that the body had been stolen. That the body had been stolen. And so there'd been this idea that perhaps it was a grave robber that had stolen Jesus out of the tomb. Just have a think about this, right? So if you're a grave robber, so if that kind of floats your fancy, if you like stealing bodies from tombs, dead bodies, I'm pretty sure you're not really concerned with how the head wrappings and the wrapping kind of ends up, right? You're not going to steal the body, grab the head wrappings, kind of, you know, fold it up and nice and plain and put it neatly on the thing. Like, I'm pretty sure that's not what you're concerned with. It just seems, like, this little detail just seems, you know, just odd. Except for the fact if it's actually how it was, and he's just recording as he remembers it. See, that's the point, John, I want to get at, is that John's just recording history, recording this as it happened. Now, the next kind of point I have there is that, to see the historical nature, is the surprise of Mary in this account when she sees the empty tomb. Now, I find this quite convincing. See, Mary, she wasn't expecting a resurrection when she first saw that the body was missing at all. She thinks, as any kind of normal, logical human being would, that the body, it's been stolen. Someone has taken him. So two times Mary says that. She says, they have taken the Lord, and we don't know where they have put him. This is exactly what you'd expect, isn't it? Kind of real people, kind of confused. What's going on? Like, trying to find it hard to figure out what has happened. So here we're talking about real people, real responses to an empty grave here. This is kind of what you'd first think. Now, some people kind of, propose that Mary and the other disciples went to the wrong tomb that Sunday morning. You know, they rocked up to a tomb, an open tomb, and saw that there was no body, and they just assumed that that was Jesus' tomb. You know, they got confused. Now, I know what it's like to get confused about places. Like, I shop at Charlestown Shopping Centre all the time. Every time I go in there without Mary, my wife, I have no idea what, you know, level I'm on, how to get to the different levels, because you can't, it's just not logical straight up and down, where the shops are, and then when I park, how do I get back to my car park, because they all look the same. But surely for Mary and the disciples, this isn't one of those kind of shopping centre, you know, details that you'd forget. This is the grave of a person that they'd walked around with for 3 years. They had followed him. They'd left everything and followed him. But the real problem with this issue, like with this kind of theory, is that if they're like, oh, they saw the wrong grave, wouldn't someone at that time just go, well, that's not the grave. He was actually buried in this, like, you know, put in this tomb. And so they'd be like, oh, okay, case over. There's no, you know, there's no missing bodies in the tomb. That's the tomb there. That, like, I just think it doesn't really make sense at that time. No one claimed that at the time. Now, it's not until in verse 16 where Jesus says to Mary, so Jesus says, Mary, that she realises that Jesus is in fact alive and in fact the one that she's been talking to. See, the body hadn't been removed or stolen. And this is kind of my fourth point here. See, Jesus, he first appears to women. Now, this is astonishing, not just the fact that there's a dead man alive, but that Jesus, being alive, the first people he reveals himself to is women. See, all four biographies, they claim that Jesus first appeared to women, and it's the women who first testify to Jesus being alive. Now, this, it may not sound like much to us here, but in the 21st century, it's a really significant point. See, a woman's testimony was considered untrustworthy by first century Jewish scholars. So in the court of law, they weren't allowed to give any evidence. And to our ears, this sounds incredibly unjust, but this, I only say this to illustrate the point of what it was like in that situation. Now, here's the thing, right? if you're making, you know, if you want to make up a story or a myth or a legend about the resurrection, and you wanted people around you to believe it, first century Jews, why would you include women as the first witnesses? See, the only reason you'd actually include it is if it actually happened and if that's how it actually went down. So lastly, my fifth point, to show the historical nature of this text, is the portrayal of Peter and the disciples in these accounts. Now, we know from the other accounts that Jesus explicitly told his disciples that he was going to die and that he's going to rise again 3 days later. See, but then in verse 9 we get this statement. So read verse 9 with me. "For they still did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead." The disciples, at that point, they haven't really kind of, it hasn't clicked for them, has it? And have a think about this for a moment. Like Peter, John, they've got the author writing it, they're like the early leaders of the Christian church when it went up. See, if they made this up, you know, if they want to create some sort of myth or legend, the founding leaders are portrayed in such a way that they're just not quite there, like they're just a little bit behind the eight ball the whole time. Why would the accounts make themselves, who are the founding leaders, look so, you know, unflattering at every point? But the disciples' response actually makes sense when you think about it, doesn't it? Like, you know, when you see an empty grave, your first thought isn't, oh, the person's alive. But they, like ordinary humans, struggling to kind of piece together and understand what's going on, didn't know, that they didn't expect the resurrection. And why? Why do you reckon it's recorded like this? I reckon it's recorded so that we might know the truth of how it actually happened. This is how it actually went down. Now, I say all these points really just to point out that this is a historical account, an eyewitness account that we have here. And perhaps you're thinking, okay, I'm with you, I'm hearing you, and I can kind of agree to that. But then you think, you're talking about a guy rising from the dead here. Like, this is crazy. I know, you know, it looks like a historical account, but we're talking about a claim that there's a dead man alive here. And seriously, that doesn't happen. How can you expect me to believe that? And I get it, right? I get that this is an extraordinary claim. I haven't seen anyone rise from the dead. And perhaps it may seem too extraordinary to believe at this point. But this kind of thought, this is exactly how Thomas responded. So he had heard all his friends say to him, "I have seen the Lord. He's alive." But Thomas, he wouldn't believe it for himself. He wanted to see it for himself. So that's Thomas. He's kind of our skeptic on the ground here. And after, read with me his response in verse 25. After the disciples have told him, you know, "We've seen Jesus, he's alive," read his response in verse 25 with me. "If I don't see the mark of the nails in his hands, put my finger into the marks of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will never believe." I love this, right? See, he's the one that's there saying the exact same things that we would think and say. So he's our skeptic on the ground here. See, Thomas, he saw Jesus crucified on a cross. He saw the nails in his hands. He saw the spear in his side. He saw the blood and the water flow out. He knew that Jesus physically died. He witnessed that with his eyes. And so we totally get why he says, "I will never believe until I personally see him myself." And I reckon it's a good thing that Thomas says this, like Thomas wants to see the evidence, because that's exactly what we want, isn't it? We want to see the evidence with such an extraordinary claim. And Thomas, he gets to see the evidence. He gets to see the risen Lord for himself. So read with me in verse 26 and 27. After 8 days, he said to his disciples, after 8 days, his disciples were indoors again, and Thomas was with them. Even though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them. He said, "Peace to you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and observe my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Don't be an unbeliever, but a believer." Jesus says to him, "See for yourself. Reach out. Touch. Observe. See the marks on my hands. See the scar on my side. See Thomas, he's our skeptic. And he here, as he sees Jesus, how does he respond? In verse 28, he says, "My Lord and my God." He says to Jesus, "You are my Lord and my God." See, the idea of someone raising from the dead seems unbelievable to be true, unless there, of course, is the existence of a God, doesn't it? I mean, if there is the existence of God, something like that is possible. And all of a sudden, after having seen Jesus alive and resurrected, this guy that he's been walking around with for the past 3 years and following, he now declares to be God. See, Thomas, he's our man on the ground. He's a skeptic, he says, and thinks the things that we would think and say. But now, as I say this about Thomas, you know, seeing the resurrected Jesus and believing, I'm sure there are a few of you here thinking, "Well, you're right. I think I'm exactly like Thomas. I'm not going to personally believe until I see Jesus myself. See, I want to see him with all the scars alive." See, it's too much, perhaps, for you to believe someone else's account. The resurrection is too much of an unbelievable event. Yet, when thinking about that, we do believe all sorts of quite unbelievable events in the history that we haven't personally witnessed with our own eyes, don't we? So on July 21st, 1969, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin were the first two astronauts to leave boot prints on the moon. See, there's actually only ever been 12 men who have actually walked on the moon since 1969. Yet, we believe that these men have actually walked on the moon, don't we? Even though we didn't go there ourselves, even though we weren't in the spacecraft walking out the window as they walked on the moon, we still believe that they were men who have walked on the moon. See, if we were to dismiss everything that seems extraordinary or unbelievable that we haven't kind of seen with our own eyes or experienced ourselves, we'd have to dismiss loads of stuff in history, wouldn't we? See, to believe in a dead man rising from the grave, we're not asking you here to throw your brain out the window and blindly believe something that there's no evidence for. We're asking you to consider the eyewitness accounts of the people who saw Jesus themselves. And we have these eyewitness accounts here. And we have Thomas, the skeptic like us, who sees Jesus himself and believes. Now, in John 20, there's a common pattern of kind of seeing Jesus and believing. So, firstly, Mary sees Jesus, she believes, and then she says to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord." And then the disciples, after seeing Jesus, they say and believe. They say to Thomas, "We have seen the Lord." And then Thomas, after seeing Jesus, he believes. But in verse 29, this pattern, it says that this pattern is going to end. So read verse 29 with me. Verse 29, Jesus said, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Those who believe without seeing are blessed." See, firstly there, Jesus affirms Thomas' response as "my Lord and my God." But then he goes on to talk and say that this pattern is going to end, and those who believe without seeing are blessed. See, this being able to see and believe, it's not going to be able to last forever. And so it's not everyone will be able to see Jesus themselves and believe in that way. It's only for those at the time who lived when Jesus died and rose again, who got to physically witness Jesus alive. And Jesus said at that point, there's going to be a time in the future where people will believe without personally seeing for themselves. And that time, it began shortly after this time we're speaking out here, where Jesus ascended to be with the Father. And it's been going on for the last 2,000 years, hasn't it? Like anyone that has questions or doubts about Jesus' resurrection, Jesus doesn't just turn up on the scene there and prove to him that way, you know, that he's alive. But Jesus says to those people for the last 2,000 years that are believing without seeing, you guys are blessed. Now, what exactly does Jesus want us to believe here? So what is it that Jesus is saying, we are blessed if we believe? I kind of want to tie it together for us here. And John, he points out three things in verses 30 and 31 that kind of bring it together for us, that bring it home. We'll read 30 to 31 and then we'll work through those three things. Read with me verse 30. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and by believing you may have life in his name. See, firstly from verse 30, we are being asked to believe in a real bodily resurrection here. So throughout John, he has been recording many signs that Jesus, many signs and miraculous things that Jesus performed, that he did when he was living. But John says this is the last of those signs. He says, I haven't recorded them all, but Jesus' death and resurrection is the final and ultimate sign being recorded for us here. And John, he wants us to believe in these signs. Now, it only takes one man to die and come back from the grave to show us that there is indeed something after the grave, doesn't it? That there is life after the grave. And at that very first Easter, 2,000 years ago, that happened. Jesus was that man. Jesus, he really did die. The tomb really was empty. And Jesus really did rise in a physical body. And that's the sign John wants us to believe here. Now, John, he doesn't only want us to believe in an event that 2,000 years ago, but he wants us to understand and believe in the implications of that event. See, what it means about who Jesus is. And that this is the second thing that we're asked to believe here. So read verse 31 with me. But these are written so that you may believe Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. See, all these signs are written so that we may know and believe that in fact Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. He's much, much more than just a moral teacher or a moral man. He wants us to see the signs and see what this means about who Jesus is, that he is the Messiah, the Son of God. And this very realization that John asks of us is the very realization that Thomas himself had, was it, when he saw the resurrected Jesus. You remember the words he spoke? My Lord, my God. See, Thomas got it. He knew what it meant about who Jesus was. But John goes further than just the implication being only about what it means about who Jesus is, and he kind of pushes it onto us, doesn't he? He pushes a response from us. So at the end of verse 31, we'll read verse 31 again. But these are written so that you may believe Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and by believing you may have life in his name. See, John, he wants us to personally believe in Jesus ourselves so that we may have life. Now, this is why the resurrection is a matter of life and death for us. It's not just an event that happened 2,000 years ago that has no influence on us now. No, today, if you believe in Jesus, you have life. See, this life that we have by believing in Jesus, it's much more than just a physical life beyond the grave. But the life that Jesus gives, it's peace with God. See, three times throughout the chapter, Jesus says to his disciples, peace to you. See, it's a matter of having peace with God or not having peace, of being God's enemy. And John wants us to believe so that we may have peace, that we may have life. See, everything is on the line here. Our life, our peace. We have good evidence here. We have the eyewitness accounts. We have the skeptic, Thomas. Don't just dismiss these evidences we have. Don't just ignore it. Check it out. Believe. Believe in this Jesus.